This is episode 16 of Dear Analyst. It's been a couple of weeks since my last episode, so sorry for not being able to keep this as updated as I'd like, but hopefully we'll keep this more regular in the future, given work, life, stuff, you know how it goes. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about an article I read from the New York Times a few months ago, and it is from Lindsay Rogers Cook. And the title of the article is How We Helped Our Reporters Learn to Love Spreadsheets. Now, long story short, this blog post by Lindsay discusses how the New York Times' digital transition team wanted to help reporters and editors at the New York Times become more fluent in data, specifically data journalism. It's a very big topic and also a topic very near and dear to my heart, because I actually do teach a class as well to some up-and-coming journalists who would like to apply more data rigor to the way they do the reporting here in New York. And I found this to be very compelling in terms of the resources that they released through this blog post. So with this data training program, I wanted to kind of go through some of the resources they offer and kind of give you my feedback on the things that they are teaching, that the program is teaching to all the reporters and editors. And what's really interesting is that this, at least according to this blog post, the boot camp, as they call it, is a couple weeks and it's oversubscribed. So people are nominated to take the class, and it just shows how much people really value being able to tell stories with data. And that's something that I've really tried to level up on in my career, which is not just being able to crunch the numbers and use Excel and various other tools like Tableau, but being able to tell a story and take away the key points that I want to get across to my audience. And in the case of the New York Times, the key point you want to get across to their readers and subscribers. So at the bottom of the link, at the bottom of the blog post, near the middle of the blog post, Lindsay releases a link to a Google Drive folder, which anyone can access. And I'll link to this in the show notes as well. And the Google Drive folder contains a bunch of different things, including core skills, some case studies, applying the core skills to real life stories. And I wanted to walk through some of these documents that I came across in this Google Drive folder, and just wanted to walk through some of the skills that you learned. So I'm looking at this skills included in data training doc, and everything is done in Google Sheets, which I find also is very interesting, because normally people will think of doing data analysis in Excel, but also shows how far along Google Sheets has come along, such that a large national newspaper would train their employees using just Google Sheets. And so some of the skills that they teach: how to import data, some basic searching, sorting, filtering, freezing panes, basic math like mean, medium, sum, max, pivot tables, cleaning data, VLOOKUP, if then to categorize or clean data. And out of these, say, six bullet points, it's interesting that three out of the six are about, well, I guess a majority of it's about cleaning up data or combining data. And I can't stress how important this is, because even in the data science world, one of the biggest hurdles to be able to do data science is having dirty or messy data. And so I can tell with the New York Times, they know that in order to even do good analysis, they need to have clean data, such as adding, deleting columns, paste special, transpose, VLOOKUPs to combine data, if then to categorize data. I would even add things like text manipulation, which is using things like mid, left, right, things like that. And really happy to see that cleaning data is up near the top of the list on their core skills they teach. Scrolling down here a little more, they talk a little bit about data sets. and how to use data in stories. And I'll talk a little bit more about that and some of the resources I found in this really handy Google Drive folder. Then they have a Google Doc about cleaning up data. And again, I really think that cleaning up data is really important for doing good analysis. The first thing they talk about in this data cheat sheet for cleaning up data is freeing up PDFs. It's so funny because so much data is captured in PDFs, and there's various tools that they offer. They propose like Taboola, Comet Docs, Acrobat, Preview or PDF Split, just to get the data that's printed on a PDF into a CSV, which you can then import into Google Sheets or Excel or what have you. So I'm not sure. I don't really come across this too often in my line of work, but I can imagine when you're going through, let's say, old government documents that have been digitized, if you're lucky to see that, you probably would want to use one of these tools to extract that information into a spreadsheet for further analysis. And let's look down here at some of their data cleaning tricks. Transpose, I find that an interesting one. I don't see that being used too often, I guess. Maybe I don't use it very often, but being able to switch the axes of your data. And when I do that, it's just using paste special and then pressing E to transpose. But perhaps this helps with, sometimes maybe you have too many column headers along the top and you want to put that along the rows, so you might do a transpose. So maybe that's why they included that tip in data cleaning, but I don't find I use that tip very often. Doing text to columns, I think this is probably one of the easiest things to do in Excel or Google Sheets, but one of the very most commonly used operations, I think, in Excel for cleaning up data, because most data that has columns, most data that comes from a database is probably going to have a delimiter such as a comma or a pipe. And chances are you have to, if you want to do any meaningful analysis with that data, you have to split that data into columns using defining a delimiter like a comma, which coincidentally comes from CSVs, comma separated values. So separating data using text to columns, very, very helpful tip there. Really happy they include that in their training. Wildcards, I'm not sure what this really means. This can be used in filters or formulas to work around misspelled or messy data. I'm not sure how, I mean, maybe this is something to do with regex, but I don't really see myself using star and question mark and tilde a lot of times, but maybe this is referring to some specific function in Google Sheets that I don't use. So if anyone has any ideas about using wildcards in Google Sheets, let me know. And they also talk about using the exact formula, which I also don't use because there's the if-then statement, which I think is a little more functional than using exact. But I guess exact is nice because, you know, you can just get one, you put in two values and you just figure out whether or not they're equal or not. So that is the data cleaning doc. And I was going to walk through some of the basics, but this looks pretty basic. So the one thing I want to call out on this data cheat sheet for the basics is they list off the pros for Google Sheets and Excel. No cons, just pros. And under Excel, privacy and security, and can analyze larger amounts of data, which both are pretty true. But I think for the second point, being able to analyze large amounts of data kind of depends on the machine you have. So if you're running a small little Dell notebook, chances are you can't run large amounts of data. In terms of privacy and security, I do know that Microsoft is pushing people to use more Excel online to get teams more into the collaboration space instead of doing Excel, the standalone program. I still think the Excel standalone program does offer the best performance. So that is the reason why, I suppose the New York Times is using Excel as a standalone program versus Excel online, which Microsoft wants to push. Google Sheets obviously has a ton of pros, which is probably why the New York Times uses Google Sheets for their training bootcamp. Cloud storage, Consort 2 million cells, collaboration sharing, obviously. Auto-saving and version history, also a very big one for when Excel accidentally crashes. Big benefit is that it's free and looks the same as other programs like Docs on different computers. So pretty standard set of pros, but I didn't think I'd see a point where boot camps at a newspaper or run on Google Sheets, which is really interesting. Makes me think about if I should do some of my trainings in Google Sheets. All right, the last two docs I want to talk about are Data Stories Brainstorming Guide and the Data-Driven Storyform Inspiration, which are both found in the Google Drive folder mentioned in the New York Times story. And this to me is, so beyond the core skills of being able to clean up your data, this is one of the aspects of data journalism. And even when I was working in kind of like a sales analytics capacity, it's not just enough. The best analysts are the ones that are able to obviously A, have the core skills to crunch the data, but B, extracting out the key interesting takeaways, the key storylines, the interesting nuggets from the data without getting lost in the data analysis itself. And so this guide talks about the 7 types of data stories. And I think this is a really interesting exercise for anyone who is trying to tell a story with data, whether you are a data generalist, whether you are working in a sales capacity and have to deliver a data-driven presentation to your client. Maybe you are just doing an internal presentation that includes a lot of data and you have to convince your team, your manager, your director to move the project in a certain direction. And so any of these types of data stories can be applied to all those scenarios, not just for data journalism, in my opinion. So change over time is the first type, how a metric has changed over time. A very simple kind of time series chart that could show how sales have increased, how births per capita have decreased, and you can tell some interesting stories when you combine different metrics together. The next topic is probably the most, I think when I first started as an analyst, the one thing that I focus on the most, which is called the drill down. Start at a wide geographic area or other division, drill down into a narrower geographic area or division, which allows you to find the root cause, or maybe like there's some 80-20 going on where in all the United States, you find out that the birth rate per capita is really driven by one small city in Ohio, for instance. The opposite is zoom out, starting at a narrow geographic area division, zoom out to a wider geographic area or division. Again, this is more from the point of view of the New York Times when they're reporting stories, but this could be applied to any kind of business scenario. Contrast, this is an interesting one, an apples-to-apples contrast of one metric, especially the min and max or the top versus the bottom of a metric, comparing countries, stats, races, sports teams. You can also compare totals to rates to show these differences. I might have to see some examples of this, but I think this is closely related to the first metric, which is change over time, because you can't do an apples to apples comparison of two metrics unless you include time, in my opinion. But I guess when there's, in the New York Times case, they're talking about country states, so I guess you could compare those since they're on a level playing ground of they're all states and countries. Intersections in a change over time metric, an intersection shows when one line catches up or passes another. I think this is probably a little more specific to data journalism, but you know, when does net profit catch up with, when do sales catch up with costs? When does headcount keep up with output? Things like that, where you show the change over time, and the intersection is always an interesting time because people want to know, like, oh, what date did, you know, more Democrats outnumber Republicans or something like that. Always a fun, interesting way to look at data. Factors, looking at a whole pie and then different slices that make up that pie, such as different races or genders. I have mixed feelings about pie charts, I'll be honest. I don't think pie charts are great at showing category breakdowns of data. I think they look nice and pretty, but it's really hard to compare different categories when a pie chart, because there's like a pie slice can be cut so many different ways. And I think it's only directional, whereas a bar chart, I think, is a much better visualization. This is getting to the nitty-gritty of data visualization. But I don't think I don't necessarily think like a pie chart is the best type of chart here. But it could be good for certain scenarios. Final one is outliers, things that are very different from the rest of the category. You can evaluate outliers by looking at the median and the spread of the data. I think this looks good in like a kind of one of like a scatter chart, like an XY scatter chart. You always want to know what the outliers are. Maybe you had a really big sale. Maybe you had a really big quarter and you want to dig in. And then you can use this outlier technique in combination with the drill down technique to find out why did that outlier become an outlier. Sometimes it might just might have been a truly an outlier, but you don't know until you make that deeper analysis. So I would really, really recommend taking a look at this brainstorming guide, because if you are just starting off with trying to tell stories about data in any kind of business or journalism scenario, knowing just having these seven tactics as a framework would really help you narrow down the story you're trying to tell to your client, to your manager, to your reader. And that is it for the New York Times Data Bootcamp. Again, really big fan of them releasing this resource for other data journalism departments and other newsrooms. I do want to read one quick story. They mentioned how they have five reporters who started using spreadsheets more and more and how it really improved their journalism reporting and storytelling. This is another article which I'll link to in the show notes. It's called How Five Data Dynamos Do Their Jobs. And I want to read the story of one person named John Ismay, at War Reporter for the New York Times. And I think his story is interesting because he talks about spreadsheets from a very, very simple implementation of spreadsheets. And this is, I think, to me, probably the way most people are using Excel. Believe it or not, I think most people are not using Excel for filtering, VLOOKUP, sorting. Only when you are really deep into the program, you can learn all those things. But a lot of people just use Excel and Google Sheets to maintain lists of data. This story, I think, illuminates that type of trend. So the story goes, when I became a reporter, I thought I never use a spreadsheet again. I had used them when I was in the Navy and when I worked for a defense contractor afterward, but I often screwed them up, so I avoided them whenever I could. As a journalist, I did the same at first. Then I started taking on projects that, in time, became too unwieldy to handle with paper printouts, manila folders, and web browser bookmarks. I had to find some way to manage tons of information. And this, I think, goes back to how I think from a journalism point of view, if you're digging into government records and into city records, you probably are coming across a lot of paper PDFs. And at the very least, you want to digitize that information and put it into a spreadsheet. I go on. Now I have multiple spreadsheets for almost every article I work on. Earlier this year, I read through an unredacted investigation report I obtained about a friendly fire incident in Vietnam. Spreadsheets helped me organize all the characters involved and the timeline of what happened as the situation went out of control 50 years ago. I also used them to save all the relevant location data I later used in Google Earth to analyze the terrain, which allowed me to ask more informed questions of the survivors. This year, I've learned even more skills that help me to quickly find storylines in sprawling databases and to be confident of my analysis. So two things that I think stand out from this story for me is, number one, again, John using Excel or Google Sheets just to keep track of articles he's working on and all the research, the characters that are involved with his stories. Not sure how much he's using data cleaning and formulas, But again, just to keep his mind organized, this is a very simple use case of Excel and probably why most people turn to a spreadsheet over a Word doc or Google doc. And I think the second thing that I want to point out, which I think is more common for anyone that's using Excel or Google Sheets at any level, is helping you find storylines and increasing your confidence in the storyline. And I think when you are able to see and analyze data in a spreadsheet over, you know, highlighting with a yellow marker on a piece of paper or on a PDF, you can get more confidence in the data because you are A, working probably with a lot more data sets and you can run quick calculations. And B, you can start seeing trends in the data, whereas it's hard to see trends in a long paragraph on a Google Doc. So I think being able to use a spreadsheet gave John not only confidence, but the ability to tell stories where he couldn't otherwise tell them had he relied on just reading these paper printouts and, you know, reading, like you said, browser bookmarks. So really cool story, and we'll include this in the show notes. Now, really quickly, I want to talk about this in the second half of the podcast, as I do with all my episodes. I want to talk about two episodes today that I have listened to recently. These are probably not too recent, given that it's been a while since I've done an episode, but here it goes. So the first episode I want to quickly talk about and mention is the A16Z podcast. This one was the episode on the history and future of machine learning with A16Z operating partner Frank Chen and Carnegie Mellon professor Tim Mitchell. And during around minute 35, they talk about how training computers, training our phones to do what we want today is still kind of reserved to the elite. And by elite, they refer to programmers, developers, and those that can actually code and write programs to make these machines do what you want. And they, in this the conversation, they say around minute 35, they kind of talk about this really interesting idea of what if we could teach computers how we want to learn and what if we could teach computers how we want them to work? And so this is different from just being able to write code, but being able to speak our language and tell the machine, tell the computer, tell the cell phone, do this speaking human language. And if I put on my, you know, in 10 years, the future of work is going to look like this, I think this conversation gets right on the head in that coding right now requires you to understand syntax and data structures and all that stuff that comes with learning how to code. But eventually it may just be being able to speak in just human words to the machine that you want it to do something, and then it'll learn how to do it, and then you can automate repetitive tasks that you wouldn't otherwise be able to automate. So in the conversation, they talk about an example of, I want you to alert me when it snows, saying like to a phone. And so right now today, if you want to check to see whether or not the forecast has snow, you would go to your weather app and check to see if the forecast has snow. And it's something that we probably do every day during the wintertime. But instead, what if you could say just word for word to the cell phone, I want you to remind me in 24 hours if the forecast has snow. And then the cell phone would say, well, how do you do this? And then you would say to the cell phone, well, 24 hours from now, or 24 hours before, right now, I want you to go into the weather app, check to see if the forecast has snow, S-N-O-W, and if it does, then ping me or alert me 24 hours in advance if you come across that scenario. So do that constantly. And I think that's a really interesting idea of just, what if we could just speak in human words to our machines and they could learn how to essentially do what we want, and it would just democratize the ability to code and create programs to the masses, which is kind of like a selfish goal of mine as well in terms of my current passions and career. Really quickly, the second episode is from another one of my perennial favorites, the Syntax FM podcast. This one is called Making Yourself Uncomfortable to Grow. And around minute 8:28 in the podcast episode, Scott and Wes, they talk about how when you are back in the day when you were writing CSS, you would use floats. And I still thought floats were a thing, but then apparently Flexbox and Grid are the new ways of writing good, proper CSS. And the point that they wanted, the meta point they bring up is the fact that most people, front-end developers in this case, they might say, oh, well, you know, I'm so used to using float right and float left and it works okay. Like, I don't want to have to change to Flexbox or Grid. That's crazy. Everything already works so fine as it is. And they're saying that this is the mentality of people that are comfortable with their skill set and don't want to face being uncomfortable to essentially grow and up-level their skills. And I think this is a common character trait of myself and maybe people that are kind of stuck in their career where you feel like you are confident in your skill set and you don't want to change because you know that what you've done just works. And that leads to the bigger, I think, challenge for organizations on change management and making change happen is, well, things have always been done this way, so we're just going to keep it that way. And there's never a challenge to the ideas, the status quo. And I love this episode because it forces you to challenge yourself to be uncomfortable and to learn Flexbox and Grid and to know that there might be a better way of doing things. And then once you kind of take on that uncomfortableness, eventually it becomes more comfortable. You learn that new skill and you start realizing, holy crap, like, why did I ever use float in the past? This is so much better. But until you cross that chasm of facing your fears, you will never grow. You'll never improve your skills. And I think the biggest takeaway, very big takeaway here, is just constantly challenge yourself to learn new skills, especially when you think you have mastered one skill set and you feel confident and overconfident in your skills. And this actually leads into a book I'm reading called The Range, which I'll talk about in future episodes, by David Epstein. And it's all about overconfidence and how that skews our accuracy. But that's for a whole nother episode, and we'll talk about that in the future.